At the time when our story begins, an arbitrary beginning, it is true, but we must begin somewhere, and fix a point behind which we do not go, otherwise we too shall land in the days of Set. At this time, young Joseph already kept the flocks with his brethren, though only under rather privileged conditions, which is to say that when it pleased him to do so, he watched as they did his father's sheep, goats, and kine, on the plains of Shechem and Hebron. What sort of animals were these, and wherein different from ours? In nothing at all. They were the very same peaceful and familiar beasts, at the same stage of development as those we know. The whole history of cattle breeding, for instance of the domestic ox from the wild buffalo, lay, even in young Joseph's day, so far back in the past that far is a feeble word to use in such a connection. It has been shown that the ox was bred in the Stone Age, before the use of metal tools, that is, before the Bronze Age. This boy of the Amuru land, Joseph, with his Egyptian and Babylonian culture, was almost as remote from those dim times as we ourselves are. As for the wild sheep from which Jacob's flocks and ours were bred, we are told that it is extinct. It died out long ago. It must have been completely domesticated in the days of Set. And the breeding of the horse, the ass, the goat, and the pig, out of that wild boar which mangled Tammuz, the young shepherd, all that was accomplished in the same remote and misty past. Our historical records go back some 7,000 years, during which time no wild animal was still in process of domestication. There is no tradition nor any memory of such events. If we look at the cultivation of wild grasses and their development into cereals, the story is the same. Our species of grain, our barley, oats, rye, maize, and wheat, they are the very ones which nourished the youthful Joseph, have been cultivated so long that no botanist can trace the beginning of the process, nor any people boast of having been the first to initiate it. We are told that in the Stone Age there were 5 varieties of wheat and 3 of barley. As for the cultivation of the vine from its wild beginnings, an incomparable achievement, humanly speaking, whatever else one may think about it, tradition, echoing hollowly up from the depths of the past, ascribes it to Noah, the one upright man, survivor of the flood, the same whom Babylonians called Utnapishtim, and also Atrakasis, the exceeding wise one, who imparted to Gilgamesh, his late grandchild, hero of the legends written on the tablets, the story of the beginning of things. This upright man, then, as Joseph likewise knew, was the first to plant vineyards. Nor did Joseph consider it a very upright deed. Why could he not have planted something useful? Fig trees, for instance, or olives. But no, he chose to plant the vine, and was drunk therefrom, and in his drunkenness was mocked and shamed of his manhood. But when Joseph imagined all that to have happened not so very long ago, that miracle of the grape, perhaps some dozen of generations before his great-grandfather, his ideas of time showed themselves to be hazy indeed. The past which he so lightly invoked being actually matter of remote and primeval distances. Having said thus much, it only remains to add, however much we may pale at the thought, that those distances themselves must have lain very late in time, compared with the remoteness of the beginning of the human race, for them to have produced a civilization capable of that high emprise, the cultivation of the vine. Where, then, do they lie in time? The beginnings of human civilization. How old is it? I put the question with reference to young Joseph, whose stage of development, though remote from ours, did not essentially differ from it, aside from those less precise habits of thought of his, at which we may benevolently smile. We have only to inquire, to conjure up a whole vista of time coulisses opening out infinitely, as in mockery. When we ourselves speak of antiquity, we mostly mean the Greco-Roman world, which, relatively speaking, is of a brand new modernity. Going back to the so-called primitive population of Greece, the Pelasgians, we are told that before they settled in the islands, the latter were inhabited by the actual primitive population, a race which preceded the Phoenicians in the domination of the sea, a fact which reduces to the merest time coulisse the Phoenician claim to have been the first seafaring folk. But science is increasingly unfavorable to all these theories. But more and more it inclines to the hypothesis and the conviction that these barbarians were colonists from Atlantis, the lost continent beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which, in times gone by, united Europe with America. But whether this was the earliest region of the earth to be populated by human beings is very doubtful, so doubtful as to be unlikely. It is much more probable that the early history of civilization, including that of Noah, the exceeding wise one, is to be connected with regions of the earth's surface much older in point of time, and already long before fallen to decay. But these are foothills whereupon we may not wander, and only vaguely indicate by that before-quoted Egyptian phrase. The peoples of the East behaved with a piety equal to their wisdom when they ascribed to the gods their first knowledge of a civilized life. The red-hued folk of Mizraim saw in Osiris the martyr the benefactor who had first given them laws and taught them to cultivate the soil, being prevented finally by the plotting of the crafty Set, who attacked him like a wild boar. As for the Chinese, they consider the founder of their empire to have been an imperial half-god named Fu Shi, who introduced cattle into China and taught the priceless art of writing. Appearance, according to Solon, dated 9,000 years before that worthy's own time, from which it follows that man attained to skill in these lofty arts some 11,500 years before our era. It is clear that the art of writing is not younger than this, and very possibly much older. I speak of it in particular because Joseph entertained such a lively fondness for the art, and, unlike his brothers, early perfected himself in it, being instructed at first by Eliezer in the Babylonian as well as in the Phoenician and Hittite scripts. He had a genuine weakness for the god or idol whom in the East they called Nabu, the writer of history, and in Tyre and Sidon, Taut, in both places recognizing him as the inventor of letters and the chronicler of the beginnings of things, the Egyptian god Tot of Hermopolis, the letter-writer of the gods and the patron of science, whose office was regarded in those parts as higher than all others, that sincere, solicitous, and reasonable god, who was sometimes a white-haired ape of pleasing appearance, sometimes wore an ibis head, and likewise had certain tender and spiritual affiliations with the moon, which were quite to young Joseph's taste. These predilections the youth would not have dared confess to his father Jacob, who set his face sternly against all such coquetting with idols, being even stricter in his attitude than were certain very high places themselves to which his austerity was dedicated. For Joseph's history proves that such little departures on his part into the impermissible were not visited very severely, at least not in the long run. As for the art of writing, with reference to its misty origins, it would be proper to paraphrase the Egyptian expression and say that it came from the days of Tot. The written roll is represented in the oldest Egyptian art, and we know a papyrus which belonged to Horus Send, a king of the second dynasty, 6,000 years before our era, and which even then was supposed to be so old that it was said Sendi had inherited it from Set. When Sneferu and that Cheops reigned, sons of the sun, of the fourth dynasty, and the pyramids of Giza were built, knowledge of writing was so usual amongst the lower classes that we today can read the simple inscriptions scratched by artisans on the great building blocks. But it need not surprise us that such knowledge was common property in that distant time, when we recall the priestly account of the age of the written history of Egypt. If, then, the days of an established language of signs are so unnumbered, where shall we seek for the beginnings of oral speech? The oldest, the primeval language, we are told, is Indo-Germanic, Indo-European, Sanskrit. But we may be sure that that is a beginning as hasty as any other, and that there existed a still older mother tongue, which included the roots of the Aryan as well as the Semitic and Hamitic tongues. Probably it was spoken on Atlantis, that land which is the last far and faint coulisse still dimly visible to our eyes, but which itself can scarcely be the original home of articulate man. Certain discoveries have caused the experts in the history of the earth to estimate the age of the human species at about 500,000 years. It is a scant reckoning when we consider first how science today teaches that man in his character as animal is the oldest of all mammals and was already in the latter dawn of life existing upon this earth in various zoological modes, amphibious and reptilian, before any cerebral development took place. And second, what endless and boundless expanses of time must have been at his disposal to turn the crouching, dream-wandering, marsupial type, with unseparated fingers and a sort of flickering pre-reason as his guide, such as man must have been before the time of Noah Utnapishtim, the exceeding wise, into the inventor of bow and arrow, the fire-maker, the welder of meteoric iron, the cultivator of corn and wine, the breeder of domestic cattle. In a word, into the shrewd, skillful, and in every essential respect modern human being which appears before us at the earliest gray dawn of history. A priest at the temple of Sais explained to Solon the Greek myth of Phaethon through a human experiencing of some deviation in the course of the bodies which move round the earth in space, resulting in a devastating conflagration on the earth. Certainly, it becomes clearer and clearer that the dream memory of man, formless but shaping itself ever anew after the manner of sagas, reaches back to catastrophes of vast antiquity, the tradition of which, fed by recurrent but lesser similar events, established itself among various peoples and produced that formation of coulisses which forever lures and leads onwards the traveler in time. Those verses which Joseph had heard and learned by heart related, among other things, the story of the great flood. He would in any case have known this story, even if he had not learned of it in the Babylonian tongue and version, for it existed in his western country, and especially among his own people, although not in quite the same form, but with details differing from those in the version current in the land of the rivers. Just at this very time, indeed, it was in process of establishing itself in a variant upon the eastern form. Joseph well knew the tale, how all that was flesh, the beasts of the field not excepted, had corrupted most indescribably. His way upon the earth, yes, the earth herself practiced whoredom, and deceivingly brought forth oats where wheat had been sown, and all this despite the warnings of Noah. So that the Lord and Creator, who saw his very angels involved in this abomination, at length, after a last trial of patience of 120 years, could no longer bear it and be responsible for it, but must let the judgment of the flood prevail. And now he, in his majestic good nature, which the angels in no wise shared, left open a little back door for life to escape by, in the shape of a chest, pitched and caulked, into which Noah went up with the animals. Joseph knew that, too, and knew the day on which the creatures entered the ark. It had been the 10th of the month Marheshvan, and on the 17th the fountains of the great deep were broken up at the time of the spring thawing, when Sirius rises in the daytime and the fountains of water begin to swell. It was on this day, then. Joseph had it from old Eliezer. But how often had this day come round since then? He did not consider that, nor did old Eliezer. And here begin the foreshortenings, the confusions and the deceptive vistas which dominate the tradition. Heaven knows when there happened that overwhelming encroachment of the Euphrates, a river at all times tending to irregular courses and sudden spate, or that startling eruption of the Persian Gulf into the solid land as the result of tornado and earthquake. That catastrophe which did not precisely create the tradition of the deluge, but gave it its final nourishment, revivified it with a horrible aspect of life and reality, and now stood to all later generations as the deluge. Perhaps the most recent catastrophe had not been so very long ago, and the nearer it was, the more fascinating becomes the question whether and how the generation which had personal experience of it succeeded in confusing their present affliction with the subject of the tradition, in other words, with the deluge. It came to pass, and that it did so need cause us to feel neither surprise nor contempt. The event consisted less in that something past repeated itself than in that it became present. But that it could acquire presentness rested upon the fact that the circumstances which brought it about were at all times present. The ways of the flesh are perennially corrupt, and may be so in all God-fearingness. For do men know whether they do well or ill before God, and whether that which seems to them good is not to the Heavenly One an abomination? Men in their folly know not God, nor the decrees of the lower world. At any time, forbearance can show itself exhausted, and judgment come into force. And there is probably always a warning voice, a knowledgeable atrachasis, who knows how to interpret signs, and by taking wise precautions, is one among 10,000 to escape destruction. Not without having first confided to the earth the tablets of knowledge, as the seed corn of future wisdom, so that when the waters subside, everything can begin afresh from the written seed. At any time, therein lies the mystery. For the mystery is timeless, but the form of timelessness is the now and the here. The deluge, then, had its theater on the Euphrates River, but also in China. Round the year 1300 before our era, there was a frightful flood in the Huang Ho, after which the course of the river was regulated. It was a repetition of the great flood of some 1,050 years before, whose Noah had been the fifth emperor, Yao, and which, chronologically speaking, was far from having been the true and original deluge, since the tradition of the latter is common to both peoples. Just as the Babylonian account, known to Joseph, was only a reproduction of earlier and earlier accounts, so the flood itself is to be referred back to older and older prototypes. One is convinced of being on solid ground at last when one fixes as the original original upon the sinking of the land Atlantis beneath the waves of the ocean, knowledge of which dread event penetrated into all the lands of the earth, previously populated from that same Atlantis, and fixed itself as a movable tradition forever in the minds of men. But it is only an apparent stop and temporary goal. According to a Chaldean computation, a period of 39,180 years lay between the deluge and the first historical dynasty of the Kingdom of the Two Rivers. It follows that the sinking of Atlantis, occurring only 9,000 years before Solon, a very recent catastrophe indeed, historically considered, certainly cannot have been the deluge. It, too, was only a repetition, the becoming present of something profoundly past, a frightful refresher to the memory. And the original story is to be referred back at least to that incalculable point of time when the island continent called Lemuria, in its turn only a remnant of the old Gondwana continent, sank beneath the waves of the Indian Ocean. What concerns us here is not calculable time. Rather, it is time's abrogation and dissolution in the alternation of tradition and prophecy, which lends to the phrase, once upon a time, its double sense of past and future, and therewith its burden of potential present. Here, the idea of reincarnation has its roots. The kings of Babel and the two Egypts, that curly-bearded Kurigalzu, as well as Horus in the palace of Thebes, called Amun, is satisfied, and all their predecessors and successors were manifestations in the flesh of the sun god. That is to say, the myth became in them a mysterium, and there was no distinction left between being and meaning. It was not until 3,000 years later that men began disputing as to whether the Eucharist was or only signified the body of the sacrifice. But even such highly supererogatory discussions as these cannot alter the fact that the essence of the mystery is and remains the timeless present. Such is the meaning of ritual, of the feast. Every Christmas, the world-saving babe is born anew and lies in the cradle, destined to suffer, to die, and to arise again. And when Joseph, in midsummer, at Shechem or at Bethlehem, at the feast of the weeping women, the feast of the burning of lamps, the feast of Tammuz, amid much wailing of flutes and joyful shoutings, relived in the explicit present the murder of the lamented son, the youthful god Osiris, Adonis, and his resurrection, there was occurring that phenomenon, the dissolution of time in mystery, which is of interest for us here, because it makes logically unobjectionable a method of thought which quite simply recognized a deluge in every visitation by water. Parallel with the story of the flood is the tale of the great tower. Common property like the other, it possessed local presentness in many places, and affords quite as good material for dreamy speculation and the formation of time coulisses. For instance, it is as certain as it is excusable that Joseph confused the great tower itself with the temple of the sun at Babel, the so-called Esagila, or house of the lifting of the head. The wanderer from Ur had doubtless done the same in his time, and it was certainly so considered not only in Joseph's sphere, but above all in the land of Shinar itself. To all the Chaldeans, Esagila, the ancient and enormous terraced tower, built, according to their belief, by Bel, the creator, with the help of the black men whom he created expressly for the purpose, and restored and completed by Hammurabi, the lawgiver, the tower, 7 stories high, of whose brilliantly enameled splendors Joseph had a lively mental picture, to all the Chaldeans, Esagila signified the present embodiment of an abstract idea handed down from faraway antiquity. The tower, the sky-soaring structure erected by human hands. In Joseph's particular milieu, the legend of the tower possessed other and more far-reaching associations, which did not, precisely speaking, belong to it, such as the idea of the dispersal. This is explainable only by the moon man's own personal attitude, his taking umbrage and going hence. For the people of Shinar had no such associations whatever with the Migdals or citadels of their cities, but rather the contrary, seeing that Hammurabi, the lawgiver, had expressly caused it to be written that he had made their summits high in order to, quote, bring together again, end of quote, the scattered and dispersing people under the sway of, quote, him who was sent, end of quote. But the moon man was thereby affronted in his notions of the deity, and in the face of Nimrod's royal policy of concentration, had dispersed himself and his. And thus, in Joseph's home, the past, made present in the shape of Esagila, had become tinctured with the future and with prophecy. A judgment hung over the towering spite monument of Nimrod's royal arrogance. Not one brick was to remain upon another, and the builders thereof would be brought to confusion and scattered by the Lord God of hosts. Thus old Eliezer taught the son of Jacob, and preserved thereby the double meaning of the once upon a time, its mingled legend and prophecy, whose product was the timeless present, the Tower of the Chaldeans. To Joseph, its story was the story of the great tower itself. But it is plain that, after all, Esagila is only a time coulisse upon our endless path toward the original tower. One time coulisse, like many another. Mizraim's people, too, looked upon the tower as present, in the form of King Cheops's amazing desert tomb. And in lands of whose existence neither Joseph nor old Eliezer had the faintest notion, in Central America, that is, the people had likewise their tower, or their image of a tower, the great pyramid of Cholula, the ruins of which are of a size and pretentiousness calculated to have aroused great anger and envy in the breast of King Cheops. The people of Cholula have always denied that they were the authors of this mighty structure. They declared it to be the work of giants, strangers from the east, they said, a superior race who, filled with drunken longing for the sun, had reared it up in their ardor out of clay and asphalt in order to draw near to the worshipped planet. There is much support for the theory that these progressive foreigners were colonists from Atlantis. And it appears that these sun-worshippers and astrologers incarnate always made it their first care, wherever they went, to set up mighty watchtowers before the faces of the astonished natives, modeled upon the high towers of their native land, and in particular upon the lofty mountain of the gods of which Plato speaks. In Atlantis, then, we may seek the prototype of the great tower. In any case, we cannot follow its history further, but must here bring to an end our researches upon this extraordinary theme. But where was paradise, the garden in the east, the place of happiness and repose, the home of man, where he ate of the tree of evil and was driven forth, or actually drove himself forth and dispersed himself? Young Joseph knew this as well as he knew about the flood, and from the same source. It made him smile a little when he heard dwellers in the Syrian desert say that the great oasis of Damascus was paradise, for that nothing more paradisial could be dreamed of than the way it lay among fruit orchards and charmingly watered gardens, nestled between majestic mountain range and spreading seas of meadow, full of bustling folk of all races and the commerce of rich wares.